Previously on Beta.
Okay, let me see if I got this straight. In order to be grounded, I've got to be crazy. And I must be crazy to keep flying. But if I ask to be grounded, that means I'm not crazy anymore and I have to keep flying.
You've got it. That's catch 22.
And I'm paying $19.5 for this vehicle here.
All right. I'll talk to my boss.
Hey, guys, I'm Dave.
What's up, Dave?
And, I'm an unappreciated bass player.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, the bizarre true story of Elizabeth Carmichael, formerly known as con artist Jerry Dean Michael, and how she reinvented herself as the marketing mastermind selling a revolutionary new three-wheeled vehicle.
She had this history of hustling and of using her charisma and charm to take advantage of people.
Director Zachary Drucker on the incredible story of the HBO docuseries The Lady and the Dale. Also, the prolific bass player Bruce Thomas. He helped shape the soundtrack of the new wave era as a member of Elvis Costello's backing band, The Attractions.
I overplayed anyway, so I was quite happy to fill in. So I guess I filled the gaps in, and bass seemed to carry quite a lot of the song structure.
But first, the life and career of Mike Nichols. Mike had a huge impact on American pop culture and entertainment. He was only in his 20s when he and Elaine May made audiences laugh with their smart and innovative improv comedy. Mike then directed four straight hit plays and went on to help reinvent American cinema with iconic films like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate. Journalist and author Mark Harris has written the detailed and deliciously addictive biography called Mike Nichols, A Life. Mark talks about Mike's unique legacy as both an accomplished director of stage and screen, and how Mike's trailblazing comedy grew from his rough start to life.
He came from Berlin as a little boy of 7 with his younger brother, who was about 4, just before it was too late for Jews to get out of Germany. It was 1939. He came over to join his father, who was a doctor and was trying to set up a practice. And then very soon after that, really close to the last possible minute, their mother came from Berlin as well. By that point, Mike had lost all of his hair because he had a reaction to vaccination that robbed him of the ability to grow hair for the rest of his life. So he really began life in New York City as a refugee and a kind of double outsider, a kid who didn't sound like other kids, a kid who didn't look like other kids. And then at a fairly early age, his father died. So it was really, there is nothing in the early years of Mike Nichols to suggest that he was going to become who he became.
Mm-hmm. How do you think Mike drew on this sense of being, as you describe it, a double outsider? How did he draw on that when he was an adult directing plays and films?
It's interesting because I'm not sure that he ever fully acknowledged that that was how his life began, that that was how his story began. But one of the things he did talk about a lot was that when you're an outsider as a kid, you become, almost as a means of survival, a really acute observer. That just to get through a day in his early life, Mike had to look at other kids and assess who are the popular ones, how do they act, what do they give off that lets you know they're popular, what do they give off that lets you know they're insecure or worried about something. And I think that kind of precision, that time he took to notice things, really fueled his first big career before he ever became a director, which was as an improv comic performer with Elaine May. I mean, all of their comedy depended on really close observation of the little tics and vanities and insecurities and pretensions of the people that they were playing.
Just think how I feel, will you? Will you think how I feel?
I know.
George is my best friend.
Your best friend.
He's my best friend.
He's my husband. Oh. One of the sweetest, gentlest people.
Oh. He's a saint.
Oh, what a good person he is.
No, he's a saint. He's a saint.
Right.
He's a saint.
Right.
The man is a saint.
You're right, he's a saint.
He happens to be the only saint I know.
He is.
He's a kind,
isn't he?
A loving.
Oh, you don't know.
Trusting.
Trusting, you don't know.
I know.
You don't know how he dressed me. He dressed me. I couldn't do it if he didn't dress me.
I know.
They had to play it in a way that was recognizable to an audience. And I think that once Mike stopped being a performer in 1962 and became a director a year later, he carried that over into his work with actors. It's the kind of performance that he really liked to draw out of an actor, something very specific and very real. And it's also the kind of performance that he could help an actor find their way to.
Mm-hmm. In 1966, Mike directed his first film, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, based on Edward Albee's play of the same name. The film starred Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. What was Mike's working relationship with Taylor and Burton like?
It was really, really strong. I think not only with Taylor and Burton, but with the other two actors in the movie, George Segal and Sandy Dennis. What Mike did on his first movie was really to create a kind of us against the world atmosphere. That his feeling was, you know, you're the highest profile couple in the world, which was indisputably true of Burton and Taylor at that time. This is an unbelievably high profile and high pressure project. It was one of the most talked about plays probably of the last 5 or 10 years. And it was a movie that, if done right, would really shake up the censorship system that governed movies in America at that time. And Mike's attitude was complicity. He would say, you know, you and I are partners in this creative thing that we're going to do. And our job is to push everyone who wants to interfere away and just try to do the best thing we can do. My job is to try to get the best performance from you and from you. And your job is to just come ready to do it.
Until he watched for a couple of years and started thinking that maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all, that maybe Georgie boy didn't have the stuff, that maybe he didn't have it in him.
Stop it, Martha.
Like hell I will. You see, George didn't have much push. He wasn't particularly aggressive. In fact, he was sort of a flop. A great big fat flop.
Stop it, Martha.
I hope that was an empty bottle, George. You can't afford to waste good liquor. Not on your salary, not on an associate professor's salary.
Really, from his very first movie, he created a situation where his actors, and Burton and Taylor were really, really different actors in terms of their facility with language, their experience with rehearsals. Burton was a very serious actor. He'd done a lot of stage work. He had done a lot of classics. Elizabeth Taylor had never even been in a rehearsal before Mike asked her to rehearse for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Yet they both trusted him completely. And that was a hallmark of Mike's work with actors throughout his entire career, that he knew not just what every actor needed, but the different thing that each actor needed to create that kind of trust.
Yeah, for sure. How was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf received by critics and the public?
It was received really, really well. I mean, even though it was this serious, somewhat highbrow play, Warner Brothers, which made the movie, knew that the combination of Burton and Taylor in the starring role, and not just in the starring roles, but in a story that was really about what happens in a marriage behind closed doors. So in some ways, it almost seemed to play with the whole mythology around Burton and Taylor themselves. Warner Brothers knew that the combination of that and the really rough language, the raw content, the sort of shocking, unsuitable for children vibe that the movie had was going to make it a huge hit. And it really was, but it was also a very, very big critical success. I mean, whatever nits critics picked with different aspects of it, I think they were all kind of shocked and impressed that Mike Nichols, who had never directed a movie before, was able to pull this off, and not only pull it off, but show them something that they hadn't seen in an American studio movie before.
Mm. Mike's second film is the one he's probably best known for, The Graduate, which was released in 1967. He cast a then-unknown Dustin Hoffman as Benjamin Braddock. How did Mike treat Hoffman while they were making the movie?
You know, it was really a complicated combination of things, their relationship. Mike handpicked Dustin Hoffman. He handpicked him over a lot of more likely stars, certainly over better known stars, because nobody knew who Dustin Hoffman was when The Graduate was made. And the way he treated Hoffman throughout the shoot, which was very long and very taxing, was with a combination of great encouragement and almost punitive severity. I mean, he would take the time with Hoffman to work out some particular feeling that Benjamin was supposed to have in any given scene. They would talk. Mike would talk about his youth. Dustin Hoffman would talk about his youth, and together they would get to something really special.
Listen, Elaine, it seems to me that there isn't a bar here. I mean, as far as I know.
Of course there is. Look, there's the palm room right there.
Good evening.
Hello.
How are you, sir?
Good evening, Mr. Gladstone.
Hello again.
Hi, Mr. Gladstone. How are you this evening?
Benjamin?
Let's get out of here, Elaine. Let's go somewhere else.
Do they know you?
Of course not.
Good evening, sir.
Come on, Elaine, we're leaving.
Mr. Gladstone, how are you?
Benjamin, what's happening?
I don't know. They must think I look like this guy Gladstone.
Hello, Mr. Brandis.
When Hoffman wasn't getting something, or when Mike wasn't happy with what he was getting, he could be really tough. And I think Dustin Hoffman told me by the end of the shoot, I don't think they really cared whether I lived or died. And I think he was half kidding, but really, everyone who worked on The Graduate says the shoot was absolutely exhausting and taxing. And really, they didn't know what they were making. Mike had the movie in his mind, but I don't think anyone involved in The Graduate, even Mike, knew what kind of a sensation it was going to be.
What is it about The Graduate that makes it such an iconic film?
Well, one really unusual thing about The Graduate is that it can be taken different ways depending on the age you are when you see it. I mean, I first saw The Graduate when I was younger than Benjamin, and he seemed like a real hero to me. And as you go through your life, in many ways, he becomes a less and less sympathetic character. When I saw it when I was in my 40s, suddenly I thought the heart of this movie, in a way, is Anne Bancroft's character, Mrs. Robinson. And she did not seem like the villain she seemed to be when I saw it when I was very young. She seemed almost a tragic figure. So I think that's one thing. And I think another thing is that even though The Graduate was taken as this kind of generation gap rallying cry when it opened in 1967, the movie isn't really that. It was criticized by some young people for, you know, not showing student protests and not dealing with the Vietnam War or with the civil rights movement. But Mike Nichols always really insisted, and so did Buck Henry, the screenwriter, that it was really a movie about a privileged, cosseted young man who was slowly beginning to rebel against the materialism and affluence that he had been absolutely surrounded by from the time he was a child. And I think that theme stands the test of time a little better than a very specifically late 1960s take on youth versus middle age would have.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I think you're absolutely right about that. Meryl Streep, Candace Bergen, and Natalie Portman loved working with Mike. Why?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. One is that specificity that we were talking about, that Meryl Streep in particular, as an actress, she's very much like Mike Nichols as a director. She's really interested in detail work. She's really interested in how the personality of a character and the motivations of a character and the desires of a character manifest themselves not just in the words, but between the lines and in physical action. That's the kind of thing that many directors won't take the time to work out or to notice even when an actor is doing it. But Mike Nichols always did. I think another reason, though, was that Mike really loved women. He didn't just love them, he appreciated them. He thought they were good collaborators. He wanted to be a good collaborator with them. And that's not a quality you see in a lot of directors of Mike's generation. He was born in 1931. But all the way through his career, whether it was a creative partner like Elaine May or actresses like Candace Bergen and Meryl Streep and Natalie Portman and Julia Roberts, or writers like Nora Ephron or Carrie Fisher, Mike really liked working with women and wasn't insecure about it at all. He enjoyed having a set full of women, and he didn't patronize them. He thought of them as collaborators, and it seems, you know, even today, that's not an entirely normal thing. And when Mike was directing, it certainly wasn't.
No, most definitely not. In the acknowledgments to your book, you write that there wasn't a day that you worked on your book that you didn't think of one more question you wished you had asked Mike. Can you point to one question that you most wished you had asked him?
I'm not sure what the one question would be, but I know that the first word of the question would be why. Because the thing that I was really trying to figure out in the book was how everything connects. It's easy to figure out chronology. That's just sort of a matter of research. But what impelled him to go from point A to point B to point C? Those were in some ways the hardest moments to fill in. Why did you make The Day of the Dolphin? Why did you stop directing movies for 7 years in the 1970s and 80s? Decisions like that, even if the answer might not have been completely factual, there were places where it would have been really illuminating to hear what he thought about why he did something. And, you know, without that, it was my job to do everything I could to figure it out anyway.
Mark Harris, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Mark Harris is the author of Mike Nichols, A Life. You can find out more about Mike Nichols at WPR.org/beta.
Law enforcement caught up to her in the end of the 1980s because of an Unsolved Mysteries episode that had aired.
Coming up, director Zachary Drucker talks about the strange but true story of Liz Carmichael and her efforts to sell America on a revolutionary new vehicle. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. In the 1970s, an energetic entrepreneur named Elizabeth Carmichael told Americans that she had the perfect way to deal with the gasoline crisis. It was a three-wheeled car that could supposedly get 70 miles to the gallon. It was called the Dale. Liz's bold claims led to a lot of media coverage and a lot of questions about her past. It turned out that in a former life, Liz was a con man named Jerry Dean Michael, who had been married 4 times. So, were Liz's claims that the Dale could challenge Big Auto just another in a series of cons? That's one of the questions raised in the fascinating 4-part HBO docuseries, The Lady and the Dale. Zachary Drucker is the co-director and executive producer of the series. She joined us to tell us about this unbelievable story.
Liz Carmichael, in the words of her daughter, was born a farm boy who was too smart for his own good. Liz transitioned in her 40s, which was in 1966, in the mid-late 1960s, but was assigned male at birth, and had a pretty mischievous and bombastic life as a petty criminal.
The Secret Life of Jerry Michael sounds a little like a second-rate grade B movie. 1961, he jumped bail in Los Angeles. He'd been arrested on a counterfeiting charge at the time. He's been arrested about 7 times, in fact, and for the last 14 years, he has been a federal fugitive, moving from house to house. In the mid-1950s, Michael was a gun runner. He was supplying the pre-Castro Cuban government of Fulgencio Batista with arms.
And the FBI, you know, continued to trail her as she re-emerged post-transition as a woman, Liz Carmichael, selling options on an energy-efficient three-wheeled car called the Dale. And that's the most succinct way I can tell the beginning of Liz's story.
Yeah, let's rewind a bit to Liz's early attempts at entrepreneurship.
Yeah, so Liz, you know, when she was presenting mail in the 1950s and 60s, was going door to door as a salesman, selling, you know, vacuum cleaners, encyclopedias. You know, her family remembers that she had a pet store in Alabama, and she was breeding tropical fish in people's basements. And she had like a brain for mechanics. And as you know, she may have been a very successful mechanical engineer in another life, but had kind of chosen this other path of petty crime.
And along the way, there were wives and children, right?
There was quite a few. Yeah. She was married 4 times before transitioning, and her last wife, Vivian Michael, remained with Liz. They co-parented their 5 children together.
And yeah. What was their life like? What was life like for the family in the early to mid-1960s?
They were a family on the run. They lived under assumed names. They would drop anything at a moment's notice and go on to the next state or the next town.
To you, waking up and having your mother make breakfast and your father going off to work might be a normal thing. To me, a normal thing was just getting used to a house and finally getting friends and then sneaking off in the middle of the night, the kids piling in the car and winding up sleeping in the car on the side of the road 10 hours later in another state. That was normal life.
Yeah, it must have been a really tough way to live, especially for the five kids.
I would have a hard time imagining what that would be like as a child and how destabilizing it would feel to not have a steady group of friends, neighborhood, all of those things. It's pretty unimaginable.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us about the car accident that eventually led to Michael becoming Elizabeth Carmichael.
Well, in the 1960s, Liz intentionally crashed her own car and, you know, left some of her own blood in it and I think shot the car to make it appear as though she had been murdered.
Jerry's car was found left on the roadside and it had his blood on it. It came out that he'd been killed. But he's still alive. I heard the mob was involved. Jerry made him unhappy. And the only way he could do it to get rid of them and hopefully get rid of the FBI and everybody else that was starting to come in, well, he shot up his car, I guess. And away he went.
She did transition in that period of time, which was authentic to who she was and who she felt herself to be. But it also was an effective way to disappear. And sure enough, we didn't include this in the series, but we found in FBI files that were later unsealed as we were finishing the series, that in 1970, the FBI continued to pursue and follow Vivian. And they even note in their file that Vivian is now living with a woman named Elizabeth Carmichael, but they didn't have it in their imagination that Liz Carmichael was Jerry Dean Michael, the person that they were looking for. So it literally says in these FBI files, Vivian is living with Elizabeth. No information can be tracked on Jerry Dean Michael. Jerry Dean Michael's nowhere to be found.
Mm-hmm. And now for the Dale. What was it and how did Liz Carmichael get involved with it?
The Dale was an invention of Dale Clift, who was a local inventor here in Los Angeles. And he had modified his motorcycle to be weatherproof so he could ride it in the winter when it rained. And he gained some notoriety riding this vehicle around, and it, you know, came to the attention of somebody who introduced him to Liz. Liz bought the option from Dale and, you know, took it and ran.
Mm-hmm. And one of the probably the defining most distinctive feature of the Dale was that it was three wheels, a three-wheeled vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, Liz made so many outrageous claims about the car that it's kind of, but it was aspirational.
My automobile will be the safest in the world. I've driven one of the prototypes into a solid concrete wall at 30, 40, and 50 miles an hour. And there was only superficial damage to the front. All that happened to me was that my face got scratched a little and I got a little bloody nose.
Liz would just say anything at any given time and then worry about backing it up later.
In your documentary, the Dale seems to have a lot of promise and looks like it might be the ticket to legitimate success for Liz. So what went wrong?
You know, Liz's past caught up to her.
If you decide you want to buy a brand new car and it's still a concept car, the manufacturer is required to put that money away in a safe account. These deposits were not put in any sort of escrow account held until the vehicles were actually produced. What happened was the deposits were used to finance the activities of the business, salaries and distributions. That runs immediately afoul of our securities laws, both federal and state.
Frankly, I never thought people would buy a car without driving it first, but apparently they will.
Carmichael was eventually arrested and charged with 31 counts, including fraud and grand theft. What was her day in court like?
Liz was in court for a long time in 1977, where it was kind of broadly asserted by the prosecution that the car in and of itself was a sort of criminal scheme. And it's conjecture to imagine if this was her shot at being a legitimate entrepreneur. I believe that she was, but also that, you know, that she had this history of hustling and of using her charisma and charm to take advantage of people.
Yeah, and it's interesting that she represented herself.
She did. She represented herself. It was one of the longest cases in Los Angeles criminal court.
Liz's case was 9 months, I seem to recall. Is that about right?
Yeah. And it was a jury
that's
trial.
That's a long time. Yeah.
These jurors were isolated in a hotel with each other for 9 months. Ultimately, the car kind of becomes a surrogate for transness, for the ways in which trans people are constantly called into question in the court of public opinion and constantly accused of fraud.
Technically, Liz Carmichael was on trial to determine whether or not she had committed a fraud in promoting the Dale. But it's pretty clear that she was on trial as a trans person. When they couldn't decide if the car was real or not, they started focusing on Liz. If she was a fraud, then the car was a fraud.
And then I think it was the day of her sentencing or the day before that Liz went on the run again. How did law enforcement finally catch up with her?
Law enforcement caught up to her in the end of the 1980s because of an Unsolved Mysteries episode that had aired.
In 1980, she failed to show up in court for sentencing. And Liz Carmichael and her five children have not been seen for over 8 years. If you have any information concerning this escaped fugitive, please call our toll-free number, 1-800-876-5353.
You know, Mamaw wasn't a recluse. She went out, went clothes shopping, went to the grocery store. When that episode aired, I think they had their caller within, like, the same day.
Update. Within minutes after this story first aired, our telecenter received an anonymous call from a viewer who recognized Liz Carmichael as a flower vendor living in Bastrop County, Texas, near Austin.
Within the first week after the airing, they came and picked her up.
After that 18 months, she went on and continued to put one foot in front of the other. Liz's story to me is so inspiring because she is incredibly resilient. And despite these incredible setbacks in life, she's able to rebuild and take care of her family over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who is Dick Carlson and what role did he play in the rise and fall of Carmichael and the Dale?
Dick Carlson was a reporter for KUBC in the 1970s. He, along with news producer Pete Noyes, created an investigative unit for the local television. And they, I think, were immediately skeptical about Liz's claims of the Dale and paid her a visit. Ultimately, Dick Carlson is the person who outs Liz Carmichael.
Introduced the story as another Dale Carr story, and then I ran a picture of Mrs. Carmichael. Then I did a slow dissolve into the crew cut Jerry Dean Michael.
Mrs. Carmichael's fingerprints match those of a notorious con man. Geraldine Elizabeth Carmichael, in reality, is a 47-year-old guy by the name of Jerry Dean Michael.
I feel like Liz's story was so mired in the bias of the time, because that assertion that she was a man masquerading as a woman to commit a crime was so persistent.
I think most people are interested in our personal life and your sex change, to be perfectly candid.
Well, whatever claim to fame I have is that as a producer of automobiles, not as a sex change artist.
Her transness was treated as a spectacle. Her identity was constantly being called into question. But if you look at what she actually did, I mean, she lived as a woman for years and years, for decades.
It erased her from even being a part of our history. I should mention I'm a transgender woman myself and am a deep enthusiast of trans history. And I was also skeptical about Liz at first. And, you know, it took kind of really investing in the story to realize how her story fit into the larger story. So what was a somewhat humble, inciting moment, I call it the story of Liz and Dick, because it reminds me of Liz Taylor and Richard Burton. Mm-hmm,
right.
But the story of Liz Carmichael and Dick Carlson is sort of a microcosm of what is today a debate that's happening around the world. And 50 years ago, those conversations were in their inception. And Liz was really thrown away. Like her story mm-hmm. was exploited and then discarded.
Mm-hmm. What might Liz's life have been like if she was born a couple of decades later? Maybe if the world had been a different place, she could have been a different person. You know, I like to think that that could be true.
Social justice movements take decades, centuries, and we have a long way to go, but we've also come a long way.
Zachary Drucker, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Doug. My pleasure.
Zachary Drucker is the co-director and executive producer of the HBO docuseries, The Lady and the Dale. Find out more about Liz Carmichael and the Dale at wpr.org/beta.
It was the right album at the right time, because I grew up on all that stuff, on Stax and Motown and R&B. That's my favorite genre.
Bassist Bruce Thomas talks about playing with Elvis Costello. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Elvis Costello emerged on the music scene as part of the punk new wave revolution that exploded during the mid-1970s. His backing band, The Attractions, was a big part of Costello's sound and his success. Bassist Bruce Thomas, drummer Pete Thomas, no relation, and keyboard player Steve Naive had the musical chops and the propulsive energy to provide the perfect accompaniment, no matter the genre, rock, soul, country, you name it. Bruce Thomas is the author of a memoir called Rough Notes, Dancing About Architecture. In the book, Bruce reminisces about working with Paul McCartney and touring on Elton John's private jet. And of course, he revisits his time as a member of The Attractions. Bruce told us how he answered an ad in the British musical magazine Melody Maker to audition for a bass player gig with an unidentified singer-songwriter. But he had a pretty good idea of just who it was.
The London music scene wasn't like huge. It was in the days of pub rock and all that kind of thing. Pretty much everybody knew what was going on the grapevine, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So when the advert came out, I had an idea. It was this guy, Elvis Costello, making a few waves. Mm. So I went out and bought the records he had out and learnt the songs and went and did the audition, pretending I was hearing the songs for the first time.
Ah, whereas you weren't. Yeah, very clever.
Very clever, eh?
Very clever indeed. And so then what happened? After you learned the songs, then what was the next step?
Well, I went to a rehearsal studio in South London
mm-hmm.
and met the artist concerned and played along.
Yeah. And what did you think of Elvis when you first met him?
I thought he was very sweaty. Elvis didn't want me in the band at all, but...
Why not?
Well, he didn't want me when I rang up for the audition because he thought I was too old school because I'd already been in bands, you see, and he was kind of going for something new, although Pete had already been on the circuit as much as I had.
Mm-hmm.
But when he asked who my favourite band was, via the woman that answered the phone, I said Steely Dan, and I heard this voice at the other end saying, get rid of him, get rid of him. And the woman said, no, he sounds like he sounds okay. So anyway, I went along, and I still think he wasn't that keen, even though I did a good audition. But Pete Thomas basically insisted that I got the job because I was in a band called Quiver.
Right.
Yeah, right. And one of our biggest fans that came to all our... Whenever we played universities, there was this student, long-haired student, who used to come along and hang around in the dressing room, who was Pete Thomas. So he said, he's good, you got to give him the job. So he, more or less, the girl who answered the phone, I ended up marrying. So between the two of them, they pretty well sorted me out.
What was it like the first time when you played with Pete Thomas and Steve Naive on keyboards, who at that time was going by his real name of Steve Nason? What was that like?
Yeah, it clicked straight away.
Straight away.
It was pretty instant. I mean, we did a week's rehearse. I can't remember when exactly the first time we played together was, whether we even kind of had a dry run before we went off and started rehearsing with that lineup. I think we just, well, Jake Riviera, Elvis's manager, probably said, right, this is the band, go off and rehearse for a week, which we did. You know, he was usually quite critical or opinionated, and he came up bounding up after we'd done our first. No one came to the rehearsals. They all the people from Stiff Records office came down to the first show, and he was came bounding up to offer his usual advice, and he just said, listen, lads, it's a world-class band.
Hmm. Yeah. The first Elvis Costello and the Attractions album was This Year's Model, which was released on March 17th, 1978. And it certainly sounded much different from Elvis's first album, My Aim Is True, because you guys weren't on that album. What do you think the Attractions brought to Elvis's songs on This Year's Model, especially?
Well, funnily enough, when the Attractions first started out, if you listen to the early, early sets, we sounded not unlike the My Aim Is True lineup, which is Clover, as you probably know,
yes,
the American country rock band.
Allison, I know this world is killing you.
And then, I don't know when it changed. I think it was during the rehearsal when we got the new material. It suddenly got a much harder, more modern edge to it. I think that was we just found our sound, you know.
Mm-hmm. You and drummer Pete Thomas were a really tight and really energetic rhythm section. How would you describe the chemistry between you and Pete?
Well, as I say, he was a big fan of mine, so there was no pulling in opposite directions. He'd do everything he could to make it work, and likewise, because he's obviously a really good drummer.
Yeah.
But he was, I mean, we used to do 200 plus gigs a year, and he used to come and knock on my door at 3 a.m. sometimes in a hotel and say, I think we should go over so-and-so, I think we could get that a bit tighter.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, yeah, I listened to some of it now and it is pretty tight. But I was told at quite an early stage in my career, when I first came to London when I was still a teenager, and I went round to John Mayall's house trying to get a job with the Blues Breakers, because when I got to London I tried to get jobs with everybody, like Jeff Beck and all sorts of people. And to their eternal credit, they all invited me in and gave me advice as well. They didn't say clear off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And John Mayall said, explain to me how you've got to, you know, you land on the one, on the root note when you play the blues, and you land on this and you do this with the bass drum and that. And I thought, right, you get that right first, you know, and then you can do the fancy stuff like James Jameson, or, you know, add a bit of melody like Paul McCartney, or go off on a flight of fancy like John Entwistle. But first of all, you've got to be Duck Dunn playing Green Onions, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then everything else is a bonus.
Yeah. One of the standout songs on this year's model is Pump It Up, which features some very propulsive and frenetic bass work from you. How did you come up with the riffs for Pump It Up?
Well, in retrospect, a lot of the time, the riffs didn't come from my fingers as much as from singing them, if you know what I mean.
Oh, really?
It's like you would sing along. I didn't realise I used to sing bass parts until I heard myself, you know, on an isolated mic doing it.
Oh, cool.
I used to often sing the parts as I was playing them, because it helps you get the phrasing right.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, I guess I was kind of half singing what the part should be. In retrospect, when I analysed it, it was actually a hybrid of a riff from an Everly Brothers song called The Price of Love, but with the notes changed to those of a Richard Hell and the Voidoids track called You've Got to Lose, and then there's a kind of an odd bar left where I played You Really Got Me.
Mm.
It's what I call organic sampling.
Organic sampling.
You know, there's nothing original, is there?
I mean, no.
But it's how you put things together in a different combination, which is original.
Sure, recycling riffs. And with so few riffs, you're being environmentally responsible.
No single-use riffs here.
No, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
I'll use that.
Yeah, please
I'll use that in another... Single-use riffs, it's a good one. You've come up with a good one there.
Oh, thank you. The first four albums you recorded with Elvis were all produced by Nick Lowe, who is, of course, a bass player. Do you think that that's one of the reasons that your bass occupies so much bandwidth in the mixes?
I used to think, back in the day, that I was getting a raw deal. You know, I was thinking, well, the bass could be a bit louder.
Mm.
So I listen back to them now, I think, crikey, they really push the bass front and center.
Yeah.
In quite a lot of the stuff, you know. But the thing is, it carries quite a lot of the songs as well.
Oh, very much so.
And I think the reason, my theory for that is that it's a bit like The Who. Pete Townshend is not known for his guitar solos, like Eric Clapton or Peter Green or, you know, Jimmy Page or anybody. He's primarily a rhythm player,
mm-hmm.
with a lead drummer and a lead bass player. And I think because there are never any guitar parts in the Attraction stuff, it was all the guitar mainly chugged away,
mm-hmm.
Lennon-esque style. And where certain embellishments were needed, or a bit of structure or a line other than a keyboard line, I overplayed anyway, so I was quite happy to fill in. So I guess I filled the gaps in, and bass seemed to carry quite a lot of the song structure.
Yeah. Well, you, Pete, Thomas, Steve Naive, and Elvis were touring the U.S. after the release of the 1979 album Armed Forces. Elvis received some negative publicity for an incident that happened in a hotel bar in Columbus, Ohio. If I understand it right, it was Stephen Stills' band were also playing in town, and then Elvis was kind of drunk and kind of having this playful banter.
Well, we all were.
Yeah.
Everyone was.
Of course, yeah. And there was this playful banter with the soul singer Bonnie Bramlett and Elvis, and that became antagonistic, and Elvis wanted to offend because he wanted to get rid of them, so he criticized Buddy Holly, Elvis Presley, and then Ray Charles and James Brown and using racial slurs.
Yeah.
And so you were a witness. You were there when this happened, right?
I was there.
Yeah.
Crikey, yeah.
Did you think at the time it was going to be like a big big blow up in the media the way it did?
I just thought it was the sort of thing that went on all the time. I didn't think they'd go run into the press. But I think Rolling Stone was quite eager to accommodate them because they were championing Bruce Springsteen at the time.
Yeah.
And they probably saw a good way of getting rid of us.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And the band's next album was called Get Happy, and it featured 20 songs, which were very influenced by Stax and Motown, R&B, and soul. It was actually, that's the album that got me interested in R&B and soul. And in your book, you ask yourself the question, were we subconsciously referencing all that was best in popular music as some kind of penance?
It would have been subconscious if it was. Mm-hmm. It wasn't conscious. And some of the language used is very emotionally loaded and taboo now, and it certainly wasn't that much at the time, and not so much in England as it was in America, for instance.
Besides the fact that you were performing songs that were very bass-driven, was there something else going on that allowed you to show your great bass skills on Get Happy?
Well, that's my album. Steve Naive hated it.
Hmm.
You know, he absolutely hated playing on that because there was nothing for him to do.
Mm.
Conversely, when we went and did the country album, he was in his element doing all his trills and twiddles on the piano. And I might have been a horse with a wooden leg, which is pretty much what all country bass parts sound like.
Right.
Clip, clop, clip, 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 you know.
Yeah.
And it was the right album at the right time because I grew up on all that stuff, on Stax and Motown and R&B. That's my favourite genre. I mean, R&B as it was known, you know, not what they call R&B now.
Yeah. One of the many highlights of Get Happy is a cover of the Sam and Dave song, I Can't Stand Up for Falling Down. And the big difference is in the tempo. Whose idea was it to speed it up so much from the original, which has a very slow tempo?
I think that was it was either Elvis or Nick, because I remember when I heard the original version being mooted as a song for the album, I said, well, why are we recording the 16th best song that Sam and Dave ever did? So I obviously didn't think much of it at the time. With the tempo changes, you know, the end choruses reference I Can't Turn You Loose, Otis Redding. So.
Yes. What are your favorite bass riffs on Get Happy? That's a tough question, I imagine, because there are so many great ones.
I'd have to sit with a track list in front of me, but I know people like Five Gears in Reverse and Opportunity. I like my raga on the end of Riot Act. Which is nothing to do with, that's, you know, as they say on Spinal Tap, don't go raga.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but yeah. I go raga at any opportunity.
Yeah. Elvis Costello first split from you, Pete, and Steve, the Attractions, in 1987. Why?
Oh, I mean, this is why it takes a chapter to go into in the book, I guess. I think he was doing a Meghan and Harry, you know.
Yeah.
He wanted to change. I think Elvis always had the long game in mind from day one, from the time that he did My Funny Valentine as a solo single only a few weeks after we formed. I think he was playing the long game, and once he started getting into string quartets and all these other things, then it was fairly obvious it was going to end up with a Nigerian nose flute ensemble at some point.
We'll look forward to that. It was so great to talk to you. Thank you very much, Bruce Thomas.
Well, thank you. Great pleasure.
Bruce Thomas is the author of Rough Notes, Dancing About Architecture. He's best known as a member of the Attractions, Elvis Costello's former backing band. Find out all about that bass, Meghan Trainor style.
Because you know I'm all about that bass, no trouble.
At WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Mark Harris, Zachary Drucker, and Bruce Thomas. If you want to hear it again, Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for WPR and Beta. Here at Beta, we pride ourselves on our re-listenability. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
I don't know who that is, and I don't care to find out.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Don't just sit there sweating like a gigantic cheese. Do something!
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
And when I get back from lunch, you people had better be hard at work.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
If that's a veiled criticism about me, I won't hear it and I won't respond to it.